From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix.
I'm Celeste Headlee in Washington, D.C. It's Here and Now. It's Orthodox Holy Week, but for the usually joyous holiday season began with tragedy for Christians in Ukraine. Deadly missile strikes hit the city of Lviv, just about 50 miles from the Polish border. NPR's Ada Peralta joins us now for more. He's in Dnipro in eastern Ukraine. But let's begin in Lviv. At least 7 people are dead there, others injured. This part of western Ukraine has been relatively peaceful since the invasion began. What can you tell us about the attack?
Yeah, look, this part of Ukraine, Lviv is in western Ukraine, not far from the border with Poland. And throughout this conflict, it has been seen as a safe haven. It had received very few airstrikes, and the city felt in a lot of ways like totally normal. Restaurants were open, people were strolling through the parks and the squares. It is home to a lot of Ukrainians who had fled from more dangerous parts of the country. But today, local authorities say that several Russian missiles struck the city. They say that civilians were killed and that one of those missiles hit a tire repair shop, but most of them were aimed at infrastructure. These are the first fatalities that have been reported in the city of Lviv. And we spoke to one resident who said that Lviv had felt safe. In fact, he was thinking about bringing his family back. But this, he says, changes everything.
In eastern Ukraine, more news from the port city of Mariupol, where they are continuing to endure a bombardment from Russian troops. Over the weekend, talks to establish a humanitarian corridor broke down, and Ukrainian authorities say the city has not fallen into Russian hands, although Russian forces are demanding surrender. What have you heard from Mariupol?
Look, I think all the signs in this country right now point toward a war that is intensifying. As you said, in Mariupol, Ukrainians say that their forces have not given up, that they're ignoring a Russian ultimatum to give up. But the problem is that Mariupol has been under siege from the beginning of this war. It has been mostly cut off from the outside world, so we don't have a clear idea of what is happening there. Farther north, the fighting in Kharkiv has intensified. Witnesses there tell us that the center of the city has been bombarded. When we were there a few days ago, the front lines were pretty stable. They weren't moving. But now the Ukrainian military says that its troops are on the offensive, that they're moving north. The big question that everyone is asking themselves right now is whether all of this new fighting is the beginning of the Russian offensive that Ukraine and its Western allies have been warning about for weeks.
So what are you hearing? Is there a difference in what Ukrainians themselves are telling you about their attitude towards this war? Has there been a strengthening of commitment? Maybe they're getting tired?
That's a really interesting question. I mean, I'm here in Dnipro, and it's surprisingly quiet. Overnight, a train station was hit by a missile strike. But everybody seems to be trying to go about their business. Yesterday, it was Palm Sunday in the Orthodox Church here. It was the beginning of Holy Week. And the air raid sirens started going up. And people just stood outside the church to wait for a priest to bless their palms. They didn't go anywhere. They didn't do anything. And, you know, I asked people, what does this Easter season mean for you? You know, Palm Sunday celebrates the coming of Jesus into Jerusalem. It's a happy occasion. And what people told me is that it wasn't the same. It didn't feel like Easter because there's always this worry that the death and destruction of this war will catch up with them.
We have heard reports, especially according to the Polish border authority, that more people are going back into Ukraine from Poland than exiting Ukraine. We assume that's connected to the Orthodox Easter holiday coming up next Sunday. Have you heard reports of people returning to Ukraine for this holiday season?
you can see them returning to many cities. The Polish authorities said that on Saturday, 22,000 people crossed from Poland into Ukraine and 19,000 left. Since this war began, millions of Ukrainians left the country. The UN estimates, however, that 650,000 have returned. I just came out of Kharkiv, which is one of the hardest hit cities. And even there, there's a trickle of people who are coming back. Authorities are telling them not to come back, even though in some places it feels relatively safe. But authorities here are saying that a new Russian offensive is very likely. And I think today, with the strike in Lviv, it was a reminder that this war is very much ongoing.
NPR's Ada Peralta in Dnipro, Ukraine. Thanks so much, Ada.
Thank you, Celeste.
Well, that suffering in Ukraine is rekindling a desire to understand the atrocities of another era, the Holocaust and the Second World War. But most Holocaust survivors who are still alive are in their 80s or 90s, and very few remain to tell their stories. So museums and archives are using new technology to preserve their testimonies. As NPR's Neda Ulibi reports, curators want these stories to resonate into the future.
At the Illinois Holocaust Museum in Skokie, you can slip on a virtual reality headset and enter the world of survivor George Brent as he stepped off a boxcar at Auschwitz.
There was a great deal of shouting, raus, raus, schnell, schnell, leave everything behind.
As you turn around on all sides, you see trembling Jewish families, SS officers with guns. They're illustrations, charcoal drawings that then melt like shadows into the actual landscape of Auschwitz today. It was amazing, George Brent said, to see his story unfold via new technology, especially because his memory is beginning to fade.
That's my problem when you're 93 years old. You forget certain things.
It gives me the chills when I think about it, that this technology became available just in time to capture these stories.
Susan Abrams runs the Illinois Holocaust Museum, where for years survivors would tell their stories to visitors in person. Abrams says the museum spent more than seven figures to recreate George Brent's testimony as a virtual reality experience, complete with location shooting in Poland and Austria. But using new technology to capture survivors' stories is nothing new. In 1946, an American psychology professor named David Boder decided to use then-cutting-edge technology to record testimonies, says Todd Presner. He studies the Holocaust and digital culture.
He brought this wire recorder to displaced persons camps throughout Europe, interviewing survivors in multiple languages, and really the first one to record their voices.
So powerful, he says, at a time when newsreels were largely silent and images of survivors were seen, not heard. Likewise, he says, the new virtual reality experience with George Brent makes the Holocaust feel immediate, especially if you've never visited a place like Auschwitz.
The camp seemed endless. Everywhere you turned.
We realize how large Auschwitz is, or we realize how small a boxcar is.
After the movie Schindler's List came out in 1993, gathering testimonies gained new momentum. Director Steven Spielberg decided to create one of the largest digital collections of survivor testimonies in the world. The USC Shoah Foundation is run right now by Corey Street, who's now standing in its quiet lobby, facing a life-size screen of an elderly man in a pink upholstered chair.
Pincus, can you tell us your story?
The man, who looks a little like the actor Anthony Hopkins, appears to compose himself. He blinks and begins.
My name is Pinchas Gutter. I was born in 1932. In Łódź.
This video of Pincus Guter is enabled by artificial intelligence to answer questions. For example, Pincus, what was life like in the Warsaw Ghetto?
An apocalyptic inferno is not even words that you can describe what went on in the ghetto.
Interactive experiences like this one are more compelling to many visitors, says Corey Street, than just passively watching archival footage of survivor testimonies, which can now be repurposed with new technology.
There's no reason we can't take these 2D testimonies, of which we have 55,000, and retrofit them to work with AI.
When you think right now about interactive museum experiences, the ones getting the most attention feature the work of famous artists.
There's a lot of debate about some of these immersive experiences, the Van Gogh one, most recently the Frida Kahlo one. People either love it or they don't, but museums, to get people in, they need to keep on this.
So will the Holocaust, the immersive experience, be coming to a museum near you? Sarah Lombard, who works at the U.S. Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C., says it's not entirely out of the question.
In VR, we've looked at how do you explain the experience of the Warsaw Ghetto? How might we explain that, really transporting you to the ghetto?
With a specific story, she says, about the Jewish resistance groups preserving evidence of what happened there. So the idea, says Shoah Foundation Director Corey Street, is not like Westworld.
There are really excellent applications of game theory to learning about Holocaust and genocide without it devolving into something that is dangerous, that is dark tourism.
At a time of rising bigotry of all sorts, and when anti-vaxxers trivialize survivors' experiences, Holocaust Museum directors say their stories are more important than ever. New technology and new tools, used correctly, can bring that history home. Neda Ulibi, NPR News.
Good music often sounds like the era in which it was born. This is Russian composer Sergei Rachmaninoff's Piano Concerto No. 2 in C minor. It was first performed in Moscow in 1901, 4 years before the first Russian Revolution, and it was the first major success for the then 28-year-old composer and piano prodigy. Turbulent times forced Rachmaninoff to leave Russia for a while. He left again for good after the 1917 revolution, when the Tsar was overthrown and Russia became the world's first communist state. It's thought that Rachmaninoff had trouble composing after that because Russia was where he felt most at home. Here and Now musical opinionator Fran Hoffner is here to opine on Rachmaninoff and his Piano Concerto No. 2. Fran, hi.
Hi.
So what more can you tell me about this time in Russia when Rachmaninoff was composing the dawn of the Russian Revolution? How do you think it may have influenced the music he was creating?
Rachmaninoff comes at a really interesting point in classical music history where he's right at the tail end of Romantic era classical music. So this is something that was not only happening in Russia, but all throughout the European art and music scene. And it's taking classical music, which the Romantic era is very interested in nature and in love and these great themes, and becoming something a little more politicized and mainstream. So Rachmaninoff sort of went back and forth between music that felt very true to the time he came up in with a rapidly changing society.
And why does it resonate with you still today?
I think the biggest draw to this piano concerto is its incredibly memorable core melody. I hear this and I can't help humming it. And it's one of those pieces I probably heard half my life ago now that I always sit down and listen to if it comes on the radio.
Well, as it is today, those were incredibly turbulent times in Russia. And I didn't realize this, but Rachmaninoff struggled with pretty severe depression. In fact, this concerto was dedicated to his psychiatrist.
Oh, I love that detail. Yeah, I think this was a piece of music that brought him out of his depression. A lot of these classical composers, you know, they feel really motivated coming out of their music education, and then their first symphonies are often not good. I think the first project of a lot of great artists, regardless of medium, is not exactly what they want it to be, and they often sink into this depression, and this is a piece of music pulls him out of it. The production of this and the composition of this concerto really helps him discover who he is as a composer.
There are some extremes in the early moments of this piece. Let's listen. What are you hearing there?
This piece to me also has a push and pull between the piano and the orchestra. Rather than leading each other around, they're kind of at odds, which I like to think maybe was a glimpse inside of Rachmaninoff's greater psyche. And I just love the dynamicism that you never know which section is going to take the piece next.
I know you also want to call attention to this section. Today, that sounds revolutionary.
Yeah, it's a really thrilling crescendo into the piano, and it gives the piano, which I think we sometimes think of as maybe a more delicate instrument, this real weight and heft to it. It's almost militaristic.
There is a really famous melody in the middle of this piece. Let's take a listen to that. Well, that's beautiful, and I think that anyone who follows music closely would agree that that is at least one of the most recognizable pieces of Russian music that there is. And as you know, many people now are trying to shun Russian artists as Russia tries to destroy Ukraine and escalate the war there. How does all that sit with you?
I think it is an overreaction to a very uncomfortable and tragic world event. But I think if we think about the place of artists in society, artists are not usually aligned with the government. Usually artists are working in opposition to a government. They try to, I think, represent the people more than they do the leaders. I think that's why we hear about starving artists a lot of the time. They're a class of people who exist without formal support of the state. And I think Russian art, Russian music is still a really important medium to learn about and to listen to because it comes from the people.
Well, and Rachmaninoff left Russia at the time of the Russian Revolution. Where do you think he stood on all that?
You know, Rachmaninoff leaving during the revolution mostly reminds me a lot of Prokofiev, who also spent a lot of time both in and outside of Russia, unsure of where he stood in Russian identity. So much of what was happening that was exciting in classical music during this time was happening in Central Europe. And I think Russian composers were not really sure where they stood, if they were Russian composers, if they were greater European composers. And some of them never felt quite at home at Russia. Some of them never felt quite at home in Europe. And I think it's one of these divides that sits heavy with Rachmaninoff and perhaps why, you know, the piano and the orchestra feel so at odds with each other in this concerto is that different parts of him are arguing with each other inside him.
Well, hold that thought, because I want to go a little bit deeper into who Rachmaninoff felt he was or where his place was in the world. But first, to get there, let's listen to this entire first minute of the final movement. Thank you. Rachmaninoff lived for a time in the United States, of course, away from his native Russia, as we said. But apparently, Fran, that was very difficult for him. He struggled to compose away from home. In the end, you know, when you listen to that piece of music there, what kind of impact do you think he ended up having?
I think sometimes composers who come in between great artist movements get ignored in the grand scheme of canon because it's difficult to place them. But I think Rachmaninoff was so ahead of his time and so unbelievably modern in his composition and in his ability to essentially write like a really catchy hook is what the theme of the symphony is. And so I think his legacy is just being so ahead of his time, of taking the lessons of the romantic composers who came before him and really kind of jettisoning out on his own.
And I know some of his fans are probably listening to this saying, yes, he composed plenty of music outside of Russia. And that's true. This is Rhapsody on a Theme of Paganini, composed in Switzerland. Let's go out on that. The Music of Rachmaninoff with Fran Hoffner. Thank you so much for telling us about this and listening with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Peter. Today is the 126th running of the Boston Marathon, but it's been only 50 years since women were officially allowed to compete. Before 1972, some believed that women weren't strong enough to run the distance and that it would damage their reproductive systems. But a few women ran anyway. Sarah Mae Berman is one of them. She actually won the Boston Marathon three times before women were sanctioned to run it. Today, she reflects on what it meant then and what it's like to see women run now.
It wasn't actually my idea to start running. After 1958, I'd had two children in 15 months and had been feeling very little control over my body. My husband Larry loved running. It made him feel happy. And he thought, why shouldn't it make me feel happy too? His idea about how I might spend my time was very unusual for that era. Back then, the ideal was June Cleaver, and she didn't play tennis or go swimming, let alone run in a road race. Back then, nobody thought women should run. Heaven forbid, they might sweat or develop ugly muscles. I started modestly. I worked up to running 2 miles around the track at MIT. I was ready to declare victory, but Larry encouraged me to run farther and faster. By 1964, I was up to 5 miles, and I was working up to running at a faster pace. On the New England running circuit, women weren't allowed official entry in any of the road races. When I ran, the men I was running with didn't mind. They encouraged me on the course. Some said they wished their wives and girlfriends would run too. By 1969, I was ready to run Boston. Larry and I ran that race together. I'll always remember making that right on Hereford and left on Boylston. It felt great. We grinned and held hands as we crossed the finish line. The 1970 race was my fastest ever. I ran a 3:05:07, that 7:03 pace. It was only in the 30s that year. A running friend gave me his gloves in Wellesley and continued on. I had to pull them on with my teeth because my hands were so cold. In 1971, I was leading the race until Nina Cusick passed me on the hill near Boston College. I really didn't like being in second. I sped up and passed her at the start of Beacon Street. I got a 30-second lead on Nina and held it until the finish. Then came 1972. the year women were finally permitted to run legally. I got the flu just before the race. I felt terrible, but I ran anyway. How could I not? 8 women ran that year. Nina, Kathy, Elaine, Ginny, Pat, Frances, Val, and me. Today, 12,200 will toe the line in Hopkinton. Nearly half the field. I couldn't have imagined that a half century ago. When I first started running, Larry told me I could be a pioneer. I didn't appreciate what that meant until much later, but now I do. If a young mother can run marathons, then women all around the world know they can too.
Sarah Mae Berman, Making History at the Boston Marathon. Her essay is at hereandnow.org. The novel O. William is out in paperback this month, written by the acclaimed author Elizabeth Strout. Today we revisit a conversation Robin Young had with Strout when the book was published last October.
Elizabeth Strout is back. Yay! She is the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Olive Kitteridge and the sequel Olive Again, about a somewhat prickly retired schoolteacher from Maine. Readers swooned. Well, Strout is now revisiting another character, Lucy Barton, from the novels My Name is Lucy Barton and Anything is Possible, a woman trying to leave her impoverished, traumatic beginnings in Illinois behind, but wearing them like a ball and chain. The new book is O. William, an exasperated phrase Lucy uses in response to her ex-husband, William. Lucy's now a successful writer living in New York, though her bleak childhood lurks. Her second husband has died, and that first one, William, needs her help, so she agrees to go on a road trip with him to Maine to help him uncover the truth about his mother, Catherine, and the sister he didn't know he had. O. William is out today, and Elizabeth Strout is here for a look at what happens when a character takes up residence in an author's head and refuses to go away. Welcome back.
Thank you so much. It's nice to be here. Thanks.
Well, this is intriguing. It's not uncommon to return to characters, but why were you so compelled to revisit Lucy?
You know, I didn't really think that I would revisit Lucy at that point, but Laura Linney, who starred in a one-woman show of My Name is Lucy Barton in London and also in New York, I was at a rehearsal with her, and she took a step forward, and she murmured something about William, and then she put her glasses up on top of her head, and at that moment, I thought, oh, William. So that's when I realized he was going to have his own story, which, of course, he would, as we all do. And then I got down to writing it. But it was really that moment when I thought, oh, William. And it's so interesting that that stayed the title all along.
Had you not fleshed out William? Because you knew William was the first husband. I mean,
right.
Yeah.
But in My Name is Lucy Barton, she consciously sidesteps him. She says to the reader, I'm not going to talk about my marriage. And then I realized, okay, well, now you're going to, except let's have him be a part of this.
Yeah.
And so it was fun to actually get to see William, and I understood him. As soon as I could visualize him, I thought, okay, I've got him.
And what would that be?
Well, all of a sudden I thought, okay, that big shaggy mustache and, you know, a full head of white hair, and yet very well-dressed and tall. And then I just thought, oh, there he is. I get it. Okay, we can do this now.
It's interesting you remind us that Lucy Barton said, well, I'm not going to talk about that now. She says that a lot. She offers herself up to narrate a book and then, you know, raises the home life that she had. But I'm not going to talk about that. Which
right.
immediately lets you know there's a story there.
Right. It was funny to realize that about William as well. Yeah. And I think in My Name is Lucy Barton, that we knew certain things about William. We knew that he had a father who had come over from Germany as a prisoner of war to work in the potato fields in Houlton, Maine, which in fact German prisoners of war did. And I had read that in a newspaper article years and years ago, and I had never forgotten that. So we knew that much about him and that his mother had been married to the potato farmer, but that's sort of all we knew. Mm-hmm. And then I realized, oh, wow, there's going to be so much there that we can figure out.
No kidding. By the way, this is like, you know, places like Aroostook, Maine, they're still potato
yeah.
farming. And
yeah.
what we find out is, and you know, this is out there in reviews, is that William's father, who again was the, you know, German Nazi POW,
right,
who was brought to the U.S., and this woman, William's mother, leaves her potato farmer husband to run away, the dish with the spoon, she runs away with the German POW. Mm-hmm. But we now find William at 71 just discovering that she left behind a daughter. He has a sister. How'd you come to that?
Well, you know, I realized that because in real life, the prisoners had to go back to either England or France and do reparations after the war. They had to go directly back to Europe and do reparations. And I realized, okay, that would be about a year would pass before William's father was able to return to the United States. And that's when I realized, okay, so in that year, she's going to have this child. And yet she's going to walk out on that baby, which is chilling.
Yeah. Had you seen any stories? And by the way, this is, we're back in Olive Kitteridge land, because we're back in Maine, and there was a certain brittleness to her.
Right.
And now we have this mother-in-law who, you know, when Lucy first meets her, this dazzling woman, you know, brings her into another world, takes her on vacations, tries to get her to play golf. And
I know.
And we see Lucy feeling like, oh, I don't belong here. She's calling people to say, what should I do when you go on vacation? She doesn't know.
I know.
But now Lucy has to grapple with, wait a minute, I wasn't the only one kind of faking my way there.
Exactly. That's exactly it. And that's when my husband and I took that exact trip. It's about 2 hours up from where we live in Maine. It was even further, actually. And we drove those exact roads, you know, from Houlton to Presque Isle and Fort Fairfield. And it was really, really interesting to try and be inside Lucy's head as I saw everything going by. And that's when I began to realize, oh, wait a minute, because mm-hmm. Catherine is going to have come from something that's arguably even worse than Lucy's background. And in My Name is Lucy Barton, I said that her mother-in-law would say, this is Lucy, she comes from nothing. And then I realized, bingo, that is why she would say it.
Right, because she did too.
Yeah, and it was just sitting there waiting for me to discover that.
Yeah, and left behind a child. And
she's, oh, I know.
Yeah, and she's passed at this point, so.
Yes, she's been gone for a while. Yes,
no,
many
nobody,
years.
Yeah, nobody. So what more are you saying here? A couple things. As I was reading, I was thinking, wow, thank goodness no one can see my interior life. Thank goodness I'm not Elizabeth Strout's character, because, again, you've got Lucy Barton, successful author, you know, gets flown places for book things. And mm-hmm. and yet how she views herself, as we hear in her interior life, is completely different.
Right. And it's so sad because her background was so deprived. You know, there was nobody in her background that reflected back to her anything that was positive. And that's why I think that she says, you know, if there was a corkboard with a pin placed in it for everybody's lives, there'd be no pin for me. Mm. Because she did not have anybody reflecting back to her who she was as a child. And I think that probably doesn't go away.
Yeah. Well, Elizabeth Strout, we have to ask. She is a successful author. You know, you're driving the same roads in Maine. Is some of this reflective of you?
No, my background was not Lucy's background at all. But she's somebody who came to me, and I find her intriguing, and I find the whole class thing intriguing. You know, what does it feel like for her mother-in-law to have crossed those lines seemingly more easily than Lucy? Mm-hmm. And then what does it feel like for Lucy to cross those lines?
Well, but what are we saying also about marriage? Because this isn't what a Hollywood script would be. The Hollywood script would be, since Lucy's second husband has just died and her first dashing husband, he of the mustache, has asked her to go on this trip to Maine, they would reach towards each other and through the pain of discovering the truth about his mother, get back together again. Well, that doesn't happen at all. I mean,
right.
What are you saying about marriage?
Well, I think that I was intrigued with these people who had known each other really from a very young age. I mean, Lucy was really quite young and he was 7 years older, but they've known each other a long, long time. And that to me was very interesting to understand that they had once been married, they had once been intimate, they had remained pretty much on friendly terms, and now they were thrown together in this. And so the tenderness that they obviously feel for each other is sitting sideways to the irritation that they continue to feel with each other. Mm-hmm. And yet they're both grown-ups now, and they're trying to do their best with it. And I was very interested in that, you know, what it would mean to be with somebody for so long in so many different permutations.
Sometimes you're the only person, you know, that can make that trip with them because you're the only one who knows.
Right, exactly.
Who that mother-in-law was. Or
that's exactly right.
Right. Elizabeth Strout's novel, Oh, William. Thank you so much.
No, thank you very much. It was lovely. Thank you so much.
Our interview from last October, Oh, William, is out in paperback next week.
If you grew up in the 1990s, you probably remember this song. So stay with me and I'll have it made. No Rain from Blind Melon was a huge hit, but so was this. That's right, Shania Twain. So what is the difference between these two artists? Well, one was a one-hit wonder, the other was an enduring hit maker, and new scientific research has something to say about why that is. Derek Thompson is a staff writer at The Atlantic. He also wrote a book about all this. It's called Hitmakers. He's on Skype. Derek, welcome.
Good to be here. Thank you.
So I want to talk about these two songs, but first, Stanford psychologist Justin Berg has a new paper on one-hit wonders. I kind of want that job. What do we learn from it?
What we learned from the book is that there is, in fact, a kind of soft science to the difference between one-hit wonders and hitmakers. And Justin Berg looked at 3 million songs released between the late 1950s and 2010. He used an algorithm to measure the song's sonic features, like their key, their tempo, their danceability. And what this did is it allowed him to quantify how similar a given hit was to the contemporary music landscape, what he called novelty, and the musical diversity of the artist's body of work, that is variety. And the first thing that he found that I thought was really interesting is that novelty is a really double-edged sword. When extremely novel acts, like say Shania Twain, who basically helped to invent the country pop crossover genre, novelty is really difficult before you break in to the mainstream. But once you break in, novelty helps to sustain your career, whereas some songs that aren't as novel are more likely to be one-hit wonders. So that's the big takeaway here about novelty. Novelty, bad before you make it, good after your first hit.
Okay, so apply that lesson to Blind Melon and No Rain. How does that help explain what happened to that song?
So the first song that you played in this segment, Blind Melon's No Rain, was released in 1992, became a hit in 1993. Rolling Stone called it one of the 10 greatest one-hit wonders of all time. In Berg's analysis, or really this Echo Nest, which is a machine learning algorithm, in their analysis of the song, it rated very low on novelty. This is dreamy guitar rock. It wasn't exactly innovative in 1992. And it was precisely for this reason that when it broke through, in large part because of a very quirky music video with a little girl dressed up as a bumblebee, the artist wasn't novel enough to sustain any kind of advantage in the marketplace. Blind Melon sounded a lot like a lot of other bands that were playing and weren't particularly popular. It was Shania Twain, on the other hand, whose novel song really marked the emergence of an entirely new genre.
Right. So we're talking about the science behind these songs, but these are also individual people who are making those songs. Those are people with different levels of talent, different levels of drive, different levels of ingenuity, I guess.
I think that's a really important point, that whenever you are looking and we're trying to answer a question that's as complicated as why do things that succeed, there's a lot of stuff that you need to factor for. What about talent? What about luck? What about some complex combination of environmental factors? The nice thing about compiling a data set of 3 million songs is that you can control for a lot of these things. So Justin Berg's analysis doesn't hinge entirely on the difference between No Rain and Shania Twain. I picked these as examples because they were really good illustrative examples, and it didn't hurt that the No Rain versus Shania Twain model happened to rhyme as well.
I like both songs. There's another phrase here that you write about. It's called hot streaks, which applies, I guess, in sports, but also in music. Tell me about that.
Hot streaks are a phenomenon that Northwestern economist Dashun Wong has looked at. This is basically a tight cluster of highly successful work in your career. So Jackson Pollock had a hot streak when it came to painting. Einstein had a hot streak at the beginning of the 20th century when it came to understanding the physical makeup of the world. Individuals have hot streaks when it comes to writing or recording great radio segments. Hot streaks are also have a science that comes down to a model that's very similar to what Justin Berg found, which is the explore-exploit model of creativity. That is that for a variety of reasons, it's very productive to explore a variety of different ideas, styles, jobs, topics. And then when you find something that looks like you've hit pay dirt, then to really exploit or focus, productively focus in that one particular area. So if you think about this for a career of someone who just graduated from college, try out a lot of things in your lower and middle 20s before focusing on something that really seems to hit that sweet point.
Oh, that's interesting. So we've been talking about music, but really the point that you're trying to make, the big picture point, is that it actually applies in a lot of different scenarios or situations.
Yeah, I don't think I find music interesting, but I only find creativity interesting to the extent that you can apply it across genres. And I think that that explore exploit in particular is a really interesting model to look at across genres. This idea that you are essentially investing in your future success when you explore a lot of different unrelated ideas, because once you hit on something that seems to work, whether it's a career or a painting style or a musical style, you can begin to combine all those things that you've learned before, and that exploitation of that very that narrow thing that you've hit upon is likely to give you your hot streak.
Derek Thompson from The Atlantic will link people to your story at hereandnow.org. All I can say is that my life is pretty plain. Derek, thank you.
Good to be here.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix.
I'm Celeste Headley in Washington, D.C. It's Here and Now.